Welcome to Paddling Adventures Radio. I'm Sean Rowley, and with me is Derek Specht.
Hello.
Derek.
Good day, sir.
The man of culture.
The man.
The man of the theater.
I like live musical stuff.
You like the sound of music, too, don't you?
I actually did.
What about Hamilton? Did you go to Hamilton?
I've never seen it.
Why not? It's a musical.
But isn't it in, like, New York City or something?
Well, it was here.
Was it here?
Yeah. Tracy and Ariana went to see it.
I didn't go.
I think Alan went with... Yeah, Alan went with them. He saved me from having to go. Alan Drummond, thank you for taking one for the team, my friend.
I'd like to see it. It's got to be on TV somewhere.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
I forgot all about that one.
But you went to the theater. You and your lovely wife took me to the theater on the weekend.
That was her anniversary gift to me. It was a weekend in Port Hope and a show at the Capitol Theater, and it was an awesome weekend.
And what was the show you saw?
It was Tom Thompson's Wake. It was really, really
good.
It was
all about Tom Thompson, who, for those that don't know, Algonquin Park, died mysteriously. Some say accidentally. Some say murder.
I want to say everybody should know who Tom Thompson is, but you know what? There's a lot of people that live under a rock, so maybe some people don't know.
Well, there's people that live overseas and people that live on the far side of the country or under a rock, whatever.
He's one of Canada's most famous artists, and arguably he's more famous because he did die. And it increased a lot of interest in him, and like some of his early art wasn't getting that, his early art wasn't that getting that great of reviews. But then he really started working on it. He had a philanthropist mentor, A.Y. Jackson, who basically paid him so he didn't have to work and gave him money and said, I want you just to paint. A.Y. Jackson is one of the Group 7.
Yeah.
Before the Group 7.
Tom Thompson wasn't. Although people consider him part of the Group of Seven, but he wasn't really part of the Group.
They said that if World War I hadn't happened, the Group of Seven would have been formed sooner, and he would have been a member of Group of Seven. And a couple of the Group of Seven always unofficially considered him a member of the Group of Seven.
Yeah. So it was a good play. There was lots of singing.
It was really there was a lot of singing. So it was. Written and the music was performed by Shipyard Kitchen Party, and so it's a lot of it has a lot of East Coast vibe to it. Really good music, and it was really well done. It was so the Capitol Theater is I've been there quite a few times now in Port Hope. They put on some really good stuff, and a lot of times we're going there for the kids. Like I think we saw Littlest Mermaid or something there once, and other things. Anyways, so. There's three cast members and then the five band members. And so it was Winnie Traynor, his lady friend, girlfriend, whatever. Then it's his buddy, Larry Dixon. I almost said Daryl Dixon. Larry Dixon, who was his...
So it was about The Walking Dead singing and dancing. Oh, now we're talking.
Anyways, Larry Dixon, who's sort of, you know, the Dixon family in Algonquin Park. And that guy was like just crude and sarcastic and angry all the time throughout the whole thing. He's like, whoa. And then there was another guy who was A.Y. Jackson. So it was all about letters to people, and they would sit at their desks and tell stories. But the whole time projected on right behind the band was like newspaper clippings and photos of Tom Thompson and Winnie and so on, and then a lot of Tom Thompson's art. It was just constantly flipping between art pieces and so on. It was really well done. It was interesting to see and hear the story as they laid it out. They started at the back end with all the clippings of him missing and looking for him and searching and finding his body and it being buried at Mowat Landing and then immediately dug up and taken to Georgian Bay and reburied there. And then they swapped right to the first. And so it was really well done. They talked about his early years, his middle years, and then his death. The music was fantastic.
Cool.
It was well done. It was like we were constantly laughing and being shocked by the Larry Dixon guy. Because he was telling, every once in a while he'd be in the spotlight telling his part of the story, and he's constantly drinking from a whiskey flask, constantly. And then he'd like, between things, you'd see him there, it's like, is he sleeping? And then the spotlight would be back on him, and he's angry now, and he's yelling drunkenly at graves and at the Mauat Landing graveyard, and talking to the dead people and so on. And at one point so when they did the intermission, this guy, he was on the middle of the stage laying up against some logs. And during intermission, the 20-minute intermission, he just leaned back and slept on stage. I'm sure he wasn't sleeping, but he portrayed sleeping on stage with his whiskey bottle. And when at the end of it, he woke up, he was being bitten by flies, and then he did the black fly dance and yada, yada, yada. And then at one point, he stopped and he put one finger up to the crowd. He goes, one second. He turns around, walks back to the band. The band all turns around, faces backwards, and he flips off his suspenders, whips his pants down, and pretends to pee on the stage. And then you can even see him shake, and I'm like, oh, my God. And then he pulls his pants back up, and and then he comes back and starts singing again. And I was like, what the heck is this? But it was really good. It was well done. It was well worth it. I messaged you to see if you were interested in going with us, but because there was lots of seats at the time I was talking to you, but it was pretty much a full house when we were there. So a lot of people
they
bought tickets at the last second.
Tend to fill up fast at the end.
So it was nice. And I've been to Port Hope a few times, but I've never stayed over, so I've never had time to walk around.
Mm-hmm. And apparently it's good in the summer.
But the whole area is beautiful. Like, we walked around town a lot and looking at homes, and some of the homes are all like early 1800s, mid 1800s. We stayed in the Waddell Hotel, which was 1843, 1845 or something. It was built, and which is nice. It's like 2.5 foot thick walls, and it was pretty cool. Really, really old hotel. And in the basement is Trattoria Augusto restaurant. Fantastic food. Like, wow, really good menu, really good food. On Monday I went to work, it's like, my clothes feel tighter.
But they're you don't need to get fat.
I might have picked up some weight over the weekend. But it was a nice Italian restaurant, really good food. They had a chef on site, and it was really nice. But like, we saw, well, it rained a lot on the Saturday, which is the day we saw the play. And we saw all the ice break up on the Ganarusk River. And cool. So as we were there, the river was roaring. There was so much rain and so much water pouring down the river. And you just heard the big, like, the ice was like over a foot thick, and it was just crashing and rolling down the falls and stuff. So much noise. And then we saw the big ice dam form down near the harbor, and it was really cool. It was very, very interesting weekend. But the old homes, like the walk through the old, like down the old part of the city, it's like, wow. It's like, oh, I think I want to move here.
Right?
It's a nice little town.
Well, it's not that far from your work.
No, it's not, actually. Yeah. A lot of people I work with I live there, so.
You could commute.
Hmm.
So, question for you.
Sure.
Tom Thompson, murder or accident?
There's so much scandal when it comes to that. I really couldn't put it on something. It was, so if you look at the historical record, which they sort of got into, they really danced around it. They danced around a few things that are rumored about the time, but they never said what they were getting at, because Winnie Traynor, after his death, her and her mother moved from Huntsville down into Pennsylvania for, say, 6 months, and then they came back. And it's like, why'd they go down there for 6 months and then come back? So there's the rumors that she had a baby.
Right.
Right? So she went down the States, had the baby, came back. They had left it up for adoption or whatever. And she never did marry and never had kids, theoretically. And so that was a little bit of that part. And so historically, though, when they did find Tom Thompson, he was out in the middle of the lake. He was probably off fishing or something, which yep. he often does. And he had a large gash on his head, and he had blood pouring out of his ear.
And he had his steel line wrapped around his feet.
His fishing line wrapped all around his body, his feet and legs. It's like, so it seems suspicious.
Yeah.
But I guess he could have tripped and fallen, rolled in the lake, trying to get, hit his head on the canoe on the way down. But he was supposedly a experienced canoeist. He did mm-hmm. whitewater all on his own. He was very experienced. He did French River up the north end of Algonquin Park. He made his way up that way and then canoed down through Algonquin Park to Canoe Lake. And he did it in a couple months or however long.
Oh, he canoed everywhere.
Yeah, he did a lot of whitewater.
He
solo
did guiding,
whitewater.
Everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Worked as a fire ranger and everything. Yeah, it's the whole, I can see, okay, he's slipped, banged his head, fell into the water. And but it's the whole, how did he get all this fishing line wrapped around him like that?
So one of the things that, and I'd heard little bits and pieces, but they really played it up in the musical, was, when he sold his first painting to the National Gallery of Canada or whatever, get $500, which was a lot of money back then, he needed new shoes. So he bought the kid's shoes and all new clothes. And then they said, but what did the kid's sister look like? She was a really good looker. And so they kept alluding to all these women that he supposedly was seeing on the side mm-hmm. from Winnie. And so there was a lot of, he was active. I don't know how to put it lightly.
Potentially active. Lots of rumors.
There's lots of rumors at the time. So he might have ticked off the wrong person.
And there was the old guy that he at the inn up there that he got into fights with because he didn't do war. He didn't go into the war.
So somebody was shaming him, and that's the summer. So he got shamed and apparently got really mad. There was
lots of arguments between the two of them.
Yes, lots of arguments. And he got so angry that he applied for an interior fire warden job that took him away for the whole summer up in the center of Algonquin Park. So nobody saw him all summer because he was so mad they kept alluding also to the fact, I don't know how many of these are facts and what's what, there's always a lot of reading between the lines, but he was very opposed to the war. He didn't agree to the war. And, that's according to the musical, right?
Yeah. And some of the rumors also, he had medical.
So yeah, they said he had like flat feet or asthma or something. So they said he tried to apply 3 different times in 3 different towns and got turned down each time. So did he not want to go to war, or could he not go to war? Anyways, his mentor, A.Y. Jackson, did go to war, and there was a lot of letter writing back and forth between the two of them. And so there was that aspect of it too, because the whole time the A.Y. Jackson guy had a military uniform on stage.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting. And I'm trying to figure out if you're not going to write this play and not do it elsewhere.
They travel all over the place.
But I couldn't find other locations to go watch it, because I'd like to go see it again. It was really good.
Well, my thing at the end of the day is I think he was mad.
Yeah, I'm 60-40 on that. 60% that he was murdered, 40% that he just had a boo-boo. Yeah. A major boo-boo.
Yeah, for all his experience and how they found the body, that just doesn't add up for me.
Yeah, it's very suspicious. Yeah.
Dive into, you can find this stuff all over the internet, into the stuff that happened when it came to his casket and moving it and the weights.
Well, they alluded to that too during the musical. They said that some kid who died like 18 years before during a log drive, that's the body they gave to Tom Thompson's brother to take back to Owen Sound.
And they're saying that it looked like indigenous person was in. And then they were also saying that it felt like they had weighted it down with stones.
Just to make it
appropriately
heavy.
Oh, the mystery of Canoe Lake.
Theoretically, they're saying he could actually still be buried on Canoe Lake.
He could still be alive.
This is a long time ago. He'd have to be, he's 1890s, when he was 1890s, he was born.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess he could be 130 years old.
Could be. You don't know. Mr. Judgy McJudgerson.
Sure. Okay.
Anyway, glad you had a great time.
It was really good.
You know what I did?
Nothing.
We're supposed to go paddling.
Oh.
But the wind on Lake Ontario was a bit much.
Yes, and it was very stormy.
Yeah, believe it or not, the rivers are still frozen over.
Oh.
There's not so much now.
The Ganaraska's clear.
A good break up this weekend. Yes. But when we were looking to go in on Saturday. So I went and did some black and white photography stuff. Some pretty cool looking stuff.
Oh. Yeah, I saw you post that.
Yeah.
Very nice.
So that's what I did. But yeah. That paddling,
I would have given it
so
a,
nice. You can just smell canoe season.
I was going to give you some thumbs up on some of your photography, but I didn't want to, your head to swell with ego or anything.
Oh, it's already there. Your your little tiny thumbs wouldn't do anything.
It's very foggy.
Oh, it was. Yeah, we would have gone out about 100 feet, and you wouldn't have seen us.
Yeah.
Right. So. Yeah, but that was it, man.
Mm-hmm.
Very productive weekends. So, might as well actually talk about what I have here to talk about.
Oh, yes. We are doing a podcast,
yeah,
aren't we?
And next week, you'll be talking about Hamilton. So, stay stay tuned for all our theater lovers.
The musical reviews at the first of the podcast.
Oh, geez. I wish I'd known about this one. Before. Sometimes when we're doing all our Googling, things don't pop up. And then all of a sudden, boop! Oh, well, that's kind of late to know about that. Ocklawaha. Some outdoor experiences in Florida are seasonal, but this paddle opportunity is only available every few years.
This would have been neat.
Mm-hmm. Rodman Reservoir's water levels are lowered, known as a drawdown, for the first time since 2020. Provides a narrow opportunity to see some amazing areas along the Ocklawaha River that are normally submerged. They talk about two popular paddling routes that can be completed within a half day or less. One can be started at Eureka West Boat Ramp and the other Orange Springs Boat Ramp. So these are just west of St. Augustine, Florida.
Yeah.
The Eureka West Boat Ramp, starting at Eureka West Boat Ramp, a short paddle down the river offers a glimpse of relics from Florida's environmental history, as two canals along the east shore can be taken to the Eureka Lock and later Eureka Dam, which were built for the Florida Barge Canal, but never put into service, and that's important for later. Undisturbed river offers views of various wading birds, lounging gators, as it twists and turns through the floodplain forest for approximately 5 miles. Rodman Reservoir, while at its normal water level, submerges 20 Florida springs.
Wow.
During the drawdown, the springs can be seen flowing into Ocklawaha once more. While many of the springs are small and difficult to reach, Cannon Springs at around mile six is visited most by spring hunters and is accessible by a short paddle up its run. Third Magnitude Spring has many curious sunfish that will approach those swimming in the spring that remain relatively still. It is quite a sight to behold on a sunny day. Just downriver of Cannon Springs, the effects of the reservoir can be seen as the floodplain forest disappears. Stumps in the wide expanse offer signs of what was lost when the reservoir was constructed. From here, a few boat ramps can be used to exit the river, such as Cypress Bayou or Orange Springs. So that's pretty cool. You're going to see some springs that are always underwater when it's in full.
So did they say exactly why they lowered it? It must be for maintenance or something,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I'll get into that in a bit here. The Orange Springs boat ramp is temporarily extended to the edge of Ocklawaha River during the drawdown. A short paddle down the river reveals the remains of a floodplain forest that perished when the reservoir was filled in the 60s. Most of the branches have decayed over time, but the submerged trunks still stand today. Its ghostly appearance is rather inviting to various wading birds, turtles, and other wildlife. Keep an eye on the distant shores for any Florida black bears, as they can occasionally be seen. The Ocklawaha winds through the tree trunks and stumps for miles, or sorry, whines. Why do they make words that look the same? Whines through the tree trunks and stumps for miles. Paddlers can exit at the temporary Kenwood boat ramp or paddle onto the reservoir. Starting mid-March, the Rodman Reservoir will be refilled, and the opportunity to see the springs and old floodplain forest will end soon after that as the water levels rise. And it may be years before these are accessible once again.
Well, now
so
we
that's
know.
Like within the next little, you know,
it's
week
filling,
or two.
It's filling now.
So, they back in the day, they decided they were going to build a dam and build a cross Florida barge canal. But this got halted in 1971. The dam has never served its intended purpose and has created tremendous ecological harm to the surrounding environment. Every few years, they lower it and it dries out and all the water lettuce dries out, dies, and then it refills. So instead of spreading chemicals and everything to get rid of all this stuff, they lower the water, they kill all of it, and then they raise it back up again.
Huh, interesting.
So, however, there's two Florida lawmakers who have put a bill into the current state legislative session to restore the Ocklawaha River. It's advancing in both chambers, now scheduled for a vote. So if it passes and goes through all the channels, all that sort of stuff, they're talking about getting rid of the dam and letting
the Ocklawaha
go back to its original course.
There you go.
So
I'm surprised it's taken this long. It's been 50 plus years.
Yeah, but they say, you know, a lot of people say it would take 100 years for the forest to recover once the dam is breached. But one of the good news things is one of these expert river captains and guides is a self-taught naturalist who's explored the tributaries and creeks along this river basin. And during the temporary drawdown, she's discovered cypress seedlings across one of the creeks. Which is very important discovery and confirmation of nature's resilience. So even though they've tried to kill all this off, there are seedlings still of cypress trees and that. And once they start coming back,
they're ready. They're just waiting to come back, waiting for air.
Whether it's 100 years or not, at least it's they're saying if man can get out of the way and let the river return to its natural historic channel, the waterway will recover. It'll return to its natural beauty and state on its own schedule, not man's. So all they have to do is take out that one dam. And also, they say that it'll allow migratory fish species to return to their historic range and spawning grounds. And the threatened Florida manatee would also be able to return in large numbers.
They would normally live in that area?
Yep.
Just held out by the dam?
Yep.
Yep. Interesting.
It's amazing what a dam will do.
I know.
So they tried to build this canal, cross Florida canal. And, 1971, they said, enough of that. We'll stop that there.
We use trucks on highways.
So, we'll see what happens from there. But, but that would be something to see, though. Like, you're out there paddling and whatnot.
It's stuff in areas that you wouldn't normally see. It's all underwater. So to see that forest that's underwater, and imagine if you were to get down there and look at the forest, it's like, oh, there's a lot of fishing lures on these trees.
I bet you. you know how we're always talking how paddling connects you to the water, to nature, and all that sort of stuff? A study conducted by the University of Hawaii in Manoa has revealed that outrigger canoe paddling is not only a state team sport, but also a way of life that brings various benefits to paddlers in Hawaii, such as physical, emotional, cultural, and spiritual well-being. Study focused on the public health aspects of paddling, led by Simone Schmidt, a former postdoctoral fellow and current adjunct assistant professor at the Thompson School of Social Work and Public Health. Whew.
That's a mouthful.
The research aimed to highlight the cultural, spiritual, and community significance that sustains long-term participation in paddling. Drawing on open-ended survey responses from paddlers across the state, the study explored the meaning of outrigger canoe paddling to individuals. Findings indicated that paddling holds multiple layers of significance, ranging from physical health benefits, stress relief to family traditions, pride, connection to the ocean and land, cultural heritage, and spirituality. An adapted social ecological model that includes a spiritual perspective, which utilized in the research. Many paddlers emphasize the importance of ancestry and traditions in their paddling experience. And Yoshida, a paddler and community author with Access Surf Hawaii, shared her personal connection to paddling and how it made her feel connected to her island home and culture. Studies suggest that cultural ties, rather than solely health-related goals, could be a key motivator for sustained participation in outrigger canoe paddling. Paddling was found to weave together health, heritage, environment, and purpose for individuals involved. Research outcomes have been communicated to canoe clubs, public health partners, to explore the potential of paddling in supporting chronic disease prevention and community-based activity programs. Interesting.
It is interesting. So you see a lot of, when it comes to cultural practices, like whether it's Indigenous Canadians or whatever, or like Hawaiians, it's, we're seeing a resurgence in the last 15 years in Canada, where they're really getting the younger generations back into their, like,
getting to know their ancestry.
Getting to know their ancestry, going out to the powwows. And so last time we went to one, it was, they discussed how the younger generation, you can earn points by how much you participate. And so these are, just a way to get them to interest is like, right? So it's interesting, that perspective. We see it here. You see it in Hawaii. It's like, this is how you get the next generation to remember their ancestry and where they came from and their cultural practices and so on.
Yeah. So, I mean, paddling can be more than just a recreational activity. Now, I know it's newer than when you're talking these going back hundreds of years and thousands of years and whatnot. But with people from our generation and stuff, well, we go out paddling because we grew up paddling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like our parents used to take us paddling. So we just sort of continued on.
Yep.
And now our kids are, maybe we're only three, four generations into it now.
Correct.
You know?
Yep.
But yeah, it's, why do you go paddling? Because we did it as kids, and it was
our main method of travel and community. Travel, community, commerce, and so on. It's like, the canoe is a big thing that tied people together before we had mass transportation and roadways and so on.
And some of us still enjoy getting back on those.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Those waterways instead of the roadways, right?
Yeah. I remember years ago at work, there was a group of us that we would be seeking out all the old Nustawagan routes Temagami. We were finding all these old routes, and we were like, we did a lot of bushwhacking trying to find, we did a lot of research into the routes and, you know, map finding and so on. And so we did, I don't know, three or four trips where we just tried to find old routes.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot of fun just to try and find the original pathways that were used for thousands of years.
And then when you get your kids into those.
Yes, absolutely.
And then hopefully they'll get their kids into that. And like I say, that's what I'm saying. It's like, we're only mm-hmm. couple of generations into it.
Yeah. And it may not be specifically my culture, but it's the indigenous culture. Yeah. It's those who came for us before us on this land. So it's really interesting, mm-hmm. and it's worthy of keeping people aware of it and renewing the interest in it
and getting that connection.
Absolutely.
This past weekend marked the beginning of a new paddle in defense of the Parana River. Initiative driven by socio-environmental organizations warning about the risks of new interventions in the river's course. This is in Argentina. The journey aims to raise awareness about the ecological impact that dredging projects and changes in the management of the river system could generate. Everybody wants to change things. And Journey called Save the Parana and its wetlands began at the so-called kilometer zero near Isla de Cerrito in the province of Chaco. From there, the participants embarked on a journey that will cover approximately 800 kilometers downstream for 14 days. Initially, the boats were supposed to depart from Las Palmas, also in Chaco. However, weather and conditions forced change in the starting point to ensure the safety of the participants. Initiative was driven by the Forum for the Recovery of the Parana and includes the participation of environmental, social, union, cultural, and student organizations from various provinces in the region. Additionally, the journey aims to connect territories and strengthen the debate on environmental future of one of South America's most important rivers. And we're seeing a lot more of this. We've been talking about this a lot, it seems, lately,
yep.
about people bringing attention to environmental issues.
Yes.
Big time in specific rivers and systems. Not just on a whole, like climate change. You know, they're talking specific issues and specific water bodies. Main concern of the participating organization is related to the project to deepen the river dredging to 44 feet to facilitate the entry of large cargo ships intended for grain export.
Mm.
According to the environmental groups, the intervention could significantly alter the natural functioning of the river ecosystem. For this reason, they consider it necessary to assess its impacts before proceeding with large-scale works. And currently, the river dredging is maintained at approximately 36 feet. However, even at that depth, changes in the dynamics of the water system have already been recorded. Effects noted include the blocking of watermouths, the reduction of lagoons and streams, and the alteration of areas that serve as refuge and breeding grounds for fish. Now, I've watched a couple of videos, and they're saying, like, even the fish and stuff like that, these will be able to cast their nets out and bring in a good haul. Now you're casting your net out and bringing in nothing.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
And that's with... there's too many people, and we do too much to the environment that we live in, which is, of course, what we're going to do. It's, uh-huh. it's, you can't help it. But it just made me think of, like, you think of the collapse of the fisheries off Newfoundland because they were overfishing. But one thing that, again, I'll go back to the musical, they showed a lot of pictures of Tom Thompson and when he was doing his guiding and fishing. And there's nothing you like more than fishing, right? Fishing, canoeing, and whatever. There's pictures of him with fish, and it's like those were massive trout that he caught.
There's one picture you always see.
He's standing behind a bar.
It looks like a fence.
Yeah, like a fence or a gate or a bar.
Yeah.
And there's these massive fish hanging off it, and it's like, oh my goodness, that's
right.
Those are big fish. They don't exist anymore.
No.
Like, it's just because of the pressure put on by fishermen and so on. But, those were some massive trout.
Mm-hmm. Mm. The wetlands associated with the Parana River form one of the most important ecological systems in South America. The environments function as natural water regulators and biodiversity reservoirs. Additionally, they act as natural filters that help improve water quality and reduce the impact of floods. Thanks to their natural structure, they also contribute to carbon storage and mitigate the effects of climate change. Ecosystems are home to a vast diversity of species of fish, birds, reptiles, and mammals. At the same time, many local communities depend on the environments for traditional activities such as artisanal fishing.
What the heck is artisanal fishing?
Well, it's like when they stand in their boat and they cast out those nets. And,
I'm going to have to look that up.
Furthermore, the wetlands play a key role in the reproductive cycles of numerous aquatic species. Therefore, the alteration of the river's natural flow can directly affect the ecological balance of the entire region. Protecting these environments has become a priority for scientists and environmental organizations working on the conservation of the Argentine coast. Did you find it?
Yes. Artisanal fishing is a small-scale, traditional, and often family-based practice using low-technology, small boats, or no boats, at or near shore fishing. Supports 90% of the world's fishing workforce and provides 40% of the global catch, largely for local consumption.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
So this start of this journey brought together representatives and organizations, residents, environmental leaders from various localities throughout the area. The event also saw significant youth participation because it's going to be their territory eventually. During the meeting, cultural activities, information, exhibitions, and spaces for debate on the river's future and the importance of preserving its ecosystems were held. Additionally, participants visited the local museums to learn about the region's historical aspects. Throughout the day, community meals were shared, presentations on the importance of the Paraná as a natural and cultural heritage were developed. So they got it. Yeah, so they're paddling down for 2 weeks.
Hmm.
Group of them are paddling all down 800 yep. miles. Is it miles or kilometers? Can't remember.
Oh. Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to guess kilometers.
Yeah, 800 kilometers.
It's because if it's not U.S., it's going to always be kilometers.
So 800 kilometers over 14 days and to bring, people knowing about what's going on there.
Oh.
Hopefully something happens. But
and this
it doesn't sound like much going from 36 to 44, but it's a lot.
It's a significant reduction. So when you think of any water system, the restriction in flow causes back pressure, which holds water up and allows water to be held up inside inlet streams and so on. Once you create enough of a free flowing, it's going to drain side wetlands and, mm-hmm. and so on, right? It you can't help it. If you create a easier flow, it's going to make other areas drain to a lower level.
And any dirt that's removed has got to be filled with water.
Yep. And anything that lives in that dirt at the bottom
is out the door.
Yes. Just like all those fields with kale and vegetables. It's like, well, when they plow those fields, a lot of animals die.
Well, they shouldn't have made kale fields to begin with. It's just nasty.
Have you ever had kale?
Yes.
It doesn't taste very good. Unless you add something to it. It's like
a garbage can?
It's like cardboard.
Yeah. There's a lot of things apparently I don't like that I'm talking about tonight. Kale and musicals.
Yeah.
The pain of my existence. A musical of kale.
Yeah.
Let's sing a song about kale. You know what's close to us?
Indiana?
Indiana.
How close is it?
Close enough. What, like 7 hours?
My geography of the U.S. is...
South of Michigan.
Yes, it is.
Between Chicago...
What's the capital?
Of Indiana?
Yeah.
Indianapolis? Where there's the Indianapolis 500?
The Brickyard?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it has, the Brickyard.
I know it is the race. For all its flat Midwestern character, Indiana actually offers a surprisingly diverse range of outdoor activities. Indiana's outdoor destinations stem from more than obvious choices like well-named Hoosier National Forest and myriad trails and campgrounds to destinations you wouldn't necessarily think to find in Indiana, like the remarkably serene shoreline and Midwest charms of Miller Beach. Inherent in that latter option is Indiana's underrated strength as a destination for recreation on the water.
Hmm.
It's not just for Formula One racers or whoever, whoever races at that brickyard thing. Because, you know, I'm a big race fan. The state does, after all, border Lake Michigan. Same time, its flat Midwestern landscape is etched with countless rivers, lakes, and waterways that offer terrific kayaking opportunities. Whether you're looking to explore a great lake, a major urban river, or a remote woodland creek, Indiana has many of the top kayaking destinations in the Midwest. Didn't know that, did you, smarty pants?
I did not. They have the tiniest little chunk of Lake Michigan.
Yep,
but they do have
just the bottom.
Yeah,
between Illinois and Michigan,
they're very close to Chicago.
Chicago. We drove through Indiana to get to Chicago on the way to Wisconsin.
Unless you go through the water.
Well, I think there is an option.
You can go way south.
No, I think there's a ferry somewhere through there.
Oh,
that takes you across.
Probably.
Yeah, I think it's just north of Chicago or something like that. Anyway. Away from the shores of Lake Michigan, Indiana has several designated water trails throughout its main waterways. Even Indiana cities offer exemplary kayaking opportunities, as many of the state's urban areas sit alongside one or more of the state's rivers. And if you want to try your hand at Great Lake kayaking, Indiana has several excellent spots to paddle out into the challenging waters of Lake Michigan. Including both local beaches where you can dip your toes into the Great Lakes and sections of epic multi-state paddling routes around the lake's vast shoreline. Though different kayaking routes will appeal to different types of kayakers, these five kayaking destinations will offer most comprehensive blend of Indiana's waterways, both urban and natural, according to reports from online reviewers and experienced kayakers. Now, looking at some of these, you can be doing them in the canoes as well, stand-up paddle boards. Like, not all this is just kayak.
Yeah.
I think it's just because people are more interested in the kayaking than the canoeing. And those people are wrong.
So right in Indiana Dunes State Park, Indiana Dunes National Park, Dune Acres, Beverly Shores, stuff like that, there's a thing there that's the 1933 Chicago World's Fair.
Mm-hmm.
In Indiana.
Yep. Yep. It moved. It migrated.
Yeah.
It was erosion. All right, so let's talk about these five top spots to kayak paddle in Indiana. Pigeon River Fish and Wildlife Area, northeastern Indiana. It's one of the state's hidden outdoor gems. Though primarily known for its hunting and fishing opportunities, the Pigeon River does provide some stellar, peaceful kayaking routes. Pigeon River Fish and Wildlife Area covers nearly 12,000 acres. The Pigeon River itself packs a fairly large punch in terms of scenery, despite its small size. Though the main navigable portion of the river is only 36 miles long, no more than half a mile wide, fairly shallow, Pigeon River flows through the scenic glacial moraine for much of its course, providing abundant woodland scenery, several wonderful lakes near the charming Indiana community of Mongo. Paddlers can take advantage of the park's 17 miles of free-flowing river for a relaxing day of unobstructed paddling in a peaceful nature preserve. All I saw is blah, 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 no portaging, blah, 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 blah. This stretch of the Pigeon River is perfect for kayakers of all ages and experience levels, given its generally calm waters combined with enough curves and bends to keep the multi-hour trip interesting. Pigeon River's banks are rich in picturesque trees and an understory of ferns that add to a unique prehistoric touch.
It's quite the river system. Mm-hmm. It is very twisty.
Fauna-wise, the Pigeon River paddling route is an excellent trip for spotting wildlife. Though it takes its name from the humble pigeon, The Pigeon River is home to numerous bird species viewable, including owls, warblers, wrens, and waterfowl. So there you go, Pigeon River.
Cool.
The next one is Fort Wayne. Fort Wayne Comets, I believe, is their minor league hockey team there. In sharp contrast to the pristine forest preserve of the Pigeon River, Fort Wayne offers some of Indiana's best opportunity for urban paddling. So that these routes, paddling routes, venture between rural and urban and a mixture of both. This makes sense as Fort Wayne sits along the banks of not one but three rivers, Indiana's St. Mary's, St. Joseph, and Maumee Rivers. They converge around Fort Wayne Riverfront, creating a perfect spot for urban kayaking or paddling in the heart of one of Indiana's most underrated cities. Fort Wayne Riverfront is a perfect nexus for the many excellent paddling trails along the three rivers. Notably, this tri-river network creates water trails that can travel north-south and east-west. Thus, kayakers embarking from Fort Wayne's riverfront can explore the city's urban views and farther out rural and forested areas in the same day. So if you're looking to explore, that's the place to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Within Fort Wayne city limits, the Riverfront Promenade Park is a perfect spot to begin your paddling excursion. Promenade Park sits along the banks of St. Mary's River near the confluence of the St. Joseph and Maumee Rivers. The park offers convenient kayak rentals courtesy of local outfitters, giving visitors plenty of options for their day on the water. If you want us to keep your kayaking excursion to a short and sweet exploration of Fort Wayne, you can sightsee the vibrant public art displays from the water while staying in view of the city's wonderful public park amenities and green spaces. So you're paddling around looking at all the artwork on the shore.
Which That's is pretty, pretty cool. Cool. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mississinewa River. Mississinewa River. Yet another underrated Indiana gem that provides superb paddling adventures through brilliant natural scenery. Originating in Ohio, the Mississinewa flows about 100 miles westward through eastern Indiana, where it runs along some of the state's most underrated natural and urban areas. On the urban side of things, the river provides the gorgeous river walk of the small yet lovely city of Marion. Urban paddlers can take advantage of Marion's convenient boat launches to explore Mississinewa's city sections. However, as charming as the Marion paddling trip is, the Mississinewa also provides superb paddling access to some of Indiana's most astounding natural wonders. Check this one out. Chief among them, these is the unforgettable Seven Pillars of the Mississinewa, with remarkable riverside limestone formations carved by water and wind erosion. The Seven Pillars are an unforgettable Indiana oasis for serene outdoor adventures. There's something about paddling a river or something like that, and big cliffs and limestone structures and stuff like that.
Hogan Lake's nice.
Add to it, right?
So I'm looking at it here. It's a really nice place, and the Mississinewa Lake is huge.
Yeah.
Massive lake.
Though the Seven Pillars Nature Preserve has excellent sightseeing trails on land, the best views of these 25-foot cliffs are arguably found on the Mississinewa River itself. Paddlers can enter the river about 3 miles upstream near Indiana's equally scenic Francis Slocum State Forest. After drifting along the forest for a few miles, the Mississinewa will eventually take you directly past the small but stunning limestone cliffs that make up the Seven Pillars. That's pretty cool, eh?
It's amazing. It's so there's
it's
so
almost like caves.
Yes, they're going to be there. It's depending on it's down by the water, so it's going to be more erosion. Mm-hmm. So it's going to form natural river level caves. It's amazing. I'm just going through the photos of the park. It's like,
there's two caves have come in on each, like a cave come on each side to leave this pillar in the middle.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool.
They're huge caves, too. Mm-hmm.
One advantage of exploring the seven pillars by paddling is that you get much better look at the unique water-carved alcoves. That's the word I was looking for, not caves.
Yeah, here you go.
Between each of the seven limestone pillars. The overall series of both the Seven Pillars and the Mississinewa River is particularly esteemed by experienced paddlers.
Here's a picture of the Seven Pillars.
Yeah, definitely Google that and look under the images and take a peek at that. That's pretty cool. The White River. Indianapolis is Indiana's capital. Ha-ha! Largest city, the central metropolitan area. It also serves as one of Indiana's top urban paddling destinations. Like many cities across the Midwest, Indianapolis was built along the banks of a major river, in this case, the prominent White River, stretching about 362 miles through much of Indiana, parts of Illinois. The White River is one of Indiana's largest waterways and a major thoroughfare for the state's urban areas. For paddlers, the White River Canoe Trail provides a perfect link between central Indiana's urban and rural paddling destinations. Centering around downtown Indianapolis riverfront, 16-mile White River Canoe Trail has put in spots at many of the city's most vibrant municipal parks, including Broad Ripple Park, Holiday Park, and Freedman Park. While these parks don't currently offer kayak rentals, the much larger White River State Park does. Located in the heart of downtown Indianapolis, White River State Park may be America's only cultural urban state park. And its kayaking opportunities provide excellent means for exploring both the White River and the city's general canal, or sorry, center canal. While Indianapolis is the urban core of the White River Canoe Trail, the White River itself stretches well beyond Indianapolis city limits. White River paddlers can find plenty of excellent paddle launching spots along the White River, north and south of the city, often within some of Indiana's loveliest parks and riverside nature reserves. Farther north, the White River also passes through the smaller, yet equally worthwhile city of Muncie. Because who hasn't heard of Muncie, Indiana?
I have.
As a cultural, right? It just, that's one of the main places you ever heard of.
Yeah.
Culturally rich, family-friendly Hamilton County, paddlers along the White River may also pass natural scenes like the White River Bluffs. There's a lot of good scenery to see in Indiana, yeah. Apparently. And the fifth one, which is somewhere I'd like to go, Indiana's only national park, also happens to be one of the Midwest's premier kayaking destinations. Indiana Dunes National Park is defined by its prominent sand dunes, but the park's magical scenery comes straight from Lake Michigan. With its relatively small area of around 15,000 acres, Indiana Dunes ranks among the American national parks that can be seen in a single day. However, these 15,000 acres preserve a strikingly complex ecosystem made up of bogs, marshes, oak savannas, rivers, and beaches, all centered around the mighty dunes that tower as high as 120 feet. Now, those are some dunes. Indiana Dunes provides a diversity of kayaking and canoeing options for paddlers to choose from. Lake Michigan is obviously the park's most prominent kayaking destination. Kayakers looking to take on the Great Lakes Challenge can launch from any of the park's beaches. Or like us in our canoe.
Yes.
Worst of worst days. However, the open waters of Lake Michigan present several challenges and hazards you're unlikely to encounter in more tranquil inland waterways. Rough currents, colder waters, and the consistent presence of very large lake freighters and barges may cause beginner kayakers to reconsider this route. If you do feel up to the challenge, Indiana Dunes National Park is a great starting point for the epic Lake Michigan Water Trail, which stretches 75 miles along the lake's southern shore from New Buffalo in Michigan to Chicago. If Lake Michigan's size is not for you, smaller but still challenging alternatives are available at Indiana Dunes Little Calumet River Water Trail and nearby waterways like Marquette Lagoon in neighboring Gary Marquette Park. So those are some pretty good ones. Pigeon River Fish and Wildlife Area, Fort Wayne, Mississinewa River, White River, and Indiana Jones. The Indiana Jones National Park.
I said that to you earlier.
Yeah, now it's stuck. Indiana Dunes National Park. I wonder if Indiana Jones has ever been there.
From Indiana Dunes National Park, there's a view across Michigan into Chicago.
Chicago.
I'm showing Sean a picture.
That's pretty nice.
Mm-hmm.
Indiana's many excellent paddling destinations span a large spectrum of locations and challenge levels. Many of Indiana's urban centers, being so often situated around rivers, have great urban paddling spots along the riverside parks, which make perfect destinations for family-friendly kayaking and canoeing day trips. On the other end of the spectrum, many of Indiana's more rural and forested areas have remote waterways that offer longer and more challenging paddling expeditions, including more advanced rapids and obstacles that may require more experience. Some of Indiana's waterway infrastructure even allows for thrilling whitewater kayaking, like the artificial whitewater rapids at South Bend's East Race Waterway. Then, of course, you have Indiana's northern shoreline along Lake Michigan, which offers formidable Great Lake kayaking journeys, more reminiscent of open ocean paddling than most lake outings.
True. Gets
so, rough. Yeah, so if you're into sea kayaking, that's perfect. Right, get out on the big Great Lakes there. So, yeah, Indiana. More into it than you thought than just car racing.
I'm sure that's a tourism line. Indiana, there's more to it than you thought.
Indiana, more than just car races.
Yeah.
People going around in their cars in a perpetual right-hand turn. Or is it left-hand turn?
Left-hand.
Left-hand turn. I wish, if I did that kind of racing, I would ask for a blinker on my car. Just the minute I put the gas on, it just blinker.
Just leave it blinking, constantly blinking.
Constantly blinking from the beginning to the end.
Left turn, Clyde.
And you know somebody eventually would just hit you because it would just bother them that much.
I'm going to hit him and take out that tail.
I'm just going to tap on the back end to break his blinker. Then it's going to become a game every race.
Yeah.
Who can take out his blinker? Here's another case of you need to know the rules and regulations. Felt a lot of emotions when I read this article.
But are they actually going to take it away from them?
Well, I don't know. But, you know, you're excited, you're happy, you're frustrated, but you're satisfied by the end. It's like some sort of movie. So kayak angler Damien Thau would have had an official... Now, see, they use words like would have had, but they don't actually say that he doesn't have it.
I think we're being gaslit here by the media.
I think so. Would have had an official record for the largest bass caught on a lake in California with a massive catch that weighed 18.75 pounds on an official scale, if not for unknowingly breaking a California law.
The person who complained is the person who had the previous record.
He's had the previous record. I want to be transparent that the monster fish and I want to own up to the mistake, he wrote in a Facebook post. Thau shared that he arrived at the lake and immediately caught a 7.5-pound bass, followed by a 10.05-pound bass. He then switched to a, okay, for all you bass fishermen out there, Mega Bass Mag Draft 10-inch. Mega Bass Mag Draft 10-inch. Now go catch a big bass.
Is that the lure?
That's the lure he used. And as he cast near a tree, landed his monster bass. That sounds like a... I don't think that'd be a... Oh, maybe 10-inch. Yes, a lure. It's not a rod.
Yeah.
Because 10-inch, yeah. Thau shared that he arrived at the lake and caught those, and he caught this monster one, fought it for 30 seconds, and then boated her. And I said, first I thought she was just another 10, maybe pushing 12, until I held her up. Thau then put the bass on the scale, but was unable to get a consistent reading due to wind and waves. The bass came in at somewhere between 17 and 17.7 pounds. But at a range doesn't work for a record, and a certified scale is needed to confirm a record. So he headed back to shore to get a more reliable reading on land, proceeded to weigh the bass on a Rapala scale, the Rapala scale, where the bass came in at 17.46 pounds. A good friend of mine was there as well, and he informed me that this is a lake record. Thau then shared that he put the bass in his live well, went back to the ramp for cell service where he called the California Fish and Game. The angler made multiple attempts to reach someone in hopes of getting his certified scale brought out to weigh the bass, to no avail. Frustrated, he reweighed her on different scale, and she went 17 pounds, 14 ounces on a Bubba Smartfish scale. So
yeah. He's name dropping here a lot.
He's just name dropping everything. So, yeah, 17.14 ounces. With a potential record in sight, he decided to transport the live fish to get weighed on a certified scale where the fish came in at 18.75 pounds. Then he drove back to the lake and released the fish. That fish had a good journey that day.
He had a good day.
Later, a friend called to congratulate him, and Thau walked his friend through the events of the day. He double-checked and informed me that even though it seemed like the right thing to do, it was against the law to transfer or move live fish.
If only people would have answered their phones, it wouldn't have been a problem. He tried to call around for a scale.
Right? But he says, not making any excuses, just want to be transparent and own up to my actions.
Good for him.
In the state of California, the movement and transport of live fish, including bass, is prohibited under California Code Regulations Title 14, Subsection 1.63, movement of live fish.
Why would that be a rule? You must kill your fish?
The law is aimed to curtail the release of invasive species, particularly the release of aquatic pets, and the language is broad and includes the prohibition of live transport of all fin fish. Now, I know there's places...
And suddenly it makes
some
sense.
Lakes you can't use live minnows.
Yes.
Because when you're done, you don't use all your minnows. What do? You dump them into the lake.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, now you've got...
Now you're an invasive species.
An invasive species or something that grows into be a predator fish. He also added that he learned a good lesson from the experience and never thought he would be in a position to hold an unofficial lake record. In the comments, Facebook users congratulated him on his catch and expressed support for the catch and release method rather than catch and kill in order to certify the record. I'm glad she's back in the lake as a spawning female, wrote one Facebook user. You still hold the lake record to us all, wrote another. At least the transparency will help people in the future. So, yes, it's a learning thing that people can learn from. But nowhere did they actually say that he wasn't given the record.
So
it's implied.
It's implied, but he only weighed it himself. It wasn't an official scale. He couldn't
get one. He took it to official scale.
Well, did he?
Yes. That's what I said. He took it to the official scale and then
he
went
back. He took it to another scale. Not the official one.
He decided to transport the live fish to get weighed on a certified scale where the fish came in at 18.75 pounds. So it did go. He does have the record. It was a certified one. But
he transported it.
Mm-hmm.
He still has the record.
He has the record. But I guess maybe he doesn't get like a certificate saying he has the record. So... This is why you got to know things. You got to check up on, you know. Yeah. But as he says, he's being transparent on it, and hopefully other people go, oh, yeah, I didn't know that. Because honestly, for most people, do you know every single rule when it comes to fishing out there?
And the way to get around that rule is to have killed the fish and then weighed it.
Yeah, which, why? Right? Unless you're going to mount it on a wall or something. Mm-hmm. But you got a big... almost a 20-pound fish.
That's a big...
That's a spawning female. Yeah. Get it back in there.
Huge.
Ha-ha. We're mid-March.
Yes, we are.
You know what's happening this weekend down in Madison, Wisconsin at the Alliant Energy Center?
Oh, Canucopia.
Canucopia is this weekend.
And what's happening here this weekend? It's going to snow.
Hopefully there's no ice on the river. That's what's happening here. Madison, Wisconsin, everything and anything to do with paddle sports under one roof. The almighty Canucopia. Rutabaga.com for more info. Yeah, definitely if you can get to it sort of thing. Outdoor Adventure Show. There's still one in Calgary and Montreal. Calgary's March 21st and 22nd. Montreal is March 28th and 29th. Go to outdooradventureshow.ca. Get all the info for these two shows. Kevin Callan went to the Vancouver one, had a great time.
Yes.
Definitely a different feel, he says, to it than the Toronto one. So I got to think the Calgary one, the Montreal one will have bits different.
Completely different vibe, yeah.
Yeah. Ottawa Outdoor and Adventure Travel Show coming up April 25th to 26th. Nepean, Ontario at the Nepean Sportsplex. Free admission and parking. Outdoor gear and equipment and paddle craft. AdventureOttawa.ca for more info. And again, Lock and Paddle looks like it's going to be July 11th this year. Lachine Canal in Montreal, up in Ottawa and in Peterborough.
And within a couple weeks, there's also a bunch of, well, for example, on April 11th is Float Your Fanny Down the Ganny. If you want to.
When is it?
April 11th. So that's like 3 weeks away or something.
April 11th. Isn't that the canoe symposium at the Canoe Museum?
Oh, is that the same weekend?
It's the same weekend. Well, it used to be the same sort of thing as when we went to Guelph, right?
Yeah. I did buy tickets for that.
So did I. What did Winky think?
I bought two tickets just in case my wife wanted to go, but I don't know if she's going or not, so I might have just supported unnecessarily.
You can sit at the front door. Tickets. Who needs tickets? You need a ticket. Come on. Tickets. Yeah. $45.
Yes, exactly. Markup. Scalpers at the front door.
That'd be awesome.
Tickets. Get your tickets.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you...
Buying, selling.
New symposium scalpers. Wow, we sold out in 2 hours. Hey, tickets. Who needs tickets? I got tickets. Oh, that'd be awesome. That's all I got. You got anything?
I've got nothing to add. I was just going to, I did mention the Float Your Fanny Down the Ganny, but there's also, like, in numerous places, there's coming up, there's going to be shoreline cleanups and so on as spring approaches, but as well, while the water's still cold and the spring runoff is there, there's lots of opportunities to float your butts down random rivers as they do every spring. Can't remember, I think it's, what is it, the Porcupine or the Beaver River in Cornwall. There's again Arraska and Port Hope. There's lots of places that do it. And so that's lots of fun stuff. We keep threatening to do the Float Your Fanny Down the Ganny in Port Hope, but we never get around to it, do we?
No, because we always end up at some canoe
symposium.
Yeah,
there's always something going on.
Yeah. There's always something going on.
Yeah.
So, and remember, if you are going out this time of year, it's March.
Be careful.
Ice is still. Mm-hmm. You know, just because it's a nice day out doesn't mean the water temperature has all of a sudden gotten nice. You will get hypothermia and you will die. Exactly. So don't get hypothermia. Don't become dead. Because that just, you know, puts a bummer on everybody's day.
It's a big damper.
Dude went out, got hypothermia on purpose.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wear your dry suits and all that sort of stuff. And I know it's like I say, that when you start smelling the dog poo in the backyard, it means everything's starting to thaw.
Everything's thawing.
Yeah, so you want to get out on those river, but hey, you got to be safe.
Like a week ago, I had giant snowbanks in my front yard, and and in my neighborhood, I'd have to, when I'd be making turns, it's like, if it's dark, you're happy that it's dark because you see headlights coming, but it's hard to see over them. And then this week, it's like I've got no snow in my front yard or backyard.
Right, we've got
all
one
gone.
One pile along the front there. And
I was able to park in front of your house without parking on a snowbank this time.
Not any fault of mine.
No, no.
I had my way.
But it was neat to come up. And there's the streets are going to be very dirty, too. Like, I parked in all this mulch of leaves and sand and dirt.
Sticks.
And,
oh, because a month and a half ago, they came by and decided this was the time of year that we need to be trimming the trees.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
Nice.
So there's little twigs and sticks.
Yeah.
And our neighbor, I guess, some of the big logs from the big branches dropped into the snow banks.
Oh.
So now that they're melting, he's got all, he just looks like somebody spread firewood on his front lawn.
Excellent.
Oh, he's going to be so happy.
Yeah.
All right. You got anything else?
Nothing.
Nothing? Well, hopefully next week I'm talking about, I went for a paddle on the weekend because it was a nice day.
Yes.
And there was water involved. I'm just going to go down and just spend my day standing next to, with my canoe, in my dry suit, next to the frozen river. And just as people walk by, they're just, what's this guy doing?
What is he doing?
He's waiting. What are you doing? I'll hold up a little sign that says, waiting for spring.
Weirdo.
Sign in one hand, coffee in the other.
Isn't that what they call that, performative art or something?
Performance art.
Performance art.
There you go. See? And you can sing because you like that sort of thing.
No, I can't sing, actually.
It's theater.
I can sing, but nobody wants to hear it.
It's on the frozen river. That's the name of our production, On the Frozen River.
The Frozen River.
Derek sings songs while Sean sits there with a sign and a coffee beside his canoe in his dry suit.
Performance art.
There you
go. We'll post it on Facebook.
There you go. All right. Well, while you're waiting for that, if you want to find out more about us, you can find us on paddlingadventuresradio.com. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. You can download or stream our episodes on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Player FM, and all your favorite podcast downloading sites. Or you can go to the episode page at paddlingadventuresradio.com, and you can stream or download all our episodes there. If you enjoyed the podcast, please share it with your friends, family, and fellow paddlers. I want to thank everybody for listening this week. I'm Sean Rowley.
And I'm Derek Specht. We'll see you next time.